It's the Popmatic Podcast for May 20th, 2015. War, what is it good for? Don't answer that.
Aw.
Don't answer that. The Popmatic Podcast, where you can rock out with your library card out. In the booth today are
Jeremy,
Amanda,
Mike,
Bill,
and I am Brian. May 25th is Memorial Day. That is the day in the United States where we remember those who have died while serving in the armed forces. The Popmatic Podcast is often irreverent. Nothing irreverent about dying in a war. But the subject of war, Jeremy can't keep it together. He can't keep it together. He's like, I'm trying to be respectful.
Mike, what? Damn it. You have to cut all this. Mike went.
I was like, don't think of an elephant. I was like, be respectful. Don't think
totally
of an elephant.
I was totally fine. And then Mike put his hand to his mouth. I thought,
I just didn't look at him.
I just wanted to see if it was me who was 12 years old.
So many irreverent kind of things came to my mind.
You did that on purpose.
It was really hard.
You did it on purpose.
He knows you.
Though nothing funny about dying in a war. War has been the subject of many great movies, books, and films, including comedies. So today, war and the books, movies, and music about war. Bill, can you start cold?
Sure. There have been many films about the Vietnam War. Apocalypse Now, The Deer Hunter, The Boys in Company C, Go Tell the Spartans. However, if you wanted to see a movie which showed how fighting the war in Vietnam actually was, that would be Platoon. Platoon was written and directed by Oliver Stone, and Oliver Stone was a veteran of the Vietnam War, and the movie is a semi-autobiographical portrait of Oliver Stone's war experiences in the Vietnam War. I remember going to the movie at the Lion's Head Theater on White Bridge Road, and there was a sign on the box office window that said if you were a veteran of the Vietnam War, you needed to bring someone with you. Vets were having a truly cathartic experience watching this movie. I've heard stories about a few freaking out, and this was across the country. There was a Time magazine article about the time the movie came out. So this movie was a healing process for a lot of vets. Platoon was a massive hit in 1986, and it was the big winner Oscar night. I think why it was such a hit is because the movie was made by a vet and of the Vietnam War, and people wanted to see what war was about. Platoon was, for the most part, a low-budget movie. Nobody really wanted to make it, but somehow Oliver Stone got the movie made, and he rose to the occasion. Honestly, I think if he had a huge budget, it would not have been as good, because in his later movies, Mr. Stone could be and can be quite flamboyant. Platoon is well worth watching because it gives you a feel of what the Vietnam War was about for the foot soldier. Amanda?
So usually I read books pretty quickly, sometimes even a book a day. But for some reason, The Monuments Man took me almost a year and a half to make it through.
Wow.
Yeah, according to my Goodreads account, I started reading it February 2014.
Wow.
And I just finished it last week, so...
It's that good,
it's
huh?
It's that good!
Riveting.
And I'll be honest, I actually had to start it twice in order to make it all the way through.
You could have built an actual monument.
I could have painted the pictures they're searching for instead of in this amount of time. But anyway, so if this title sounds familiar to you, it's probably because you've heard of the movie that they made in 2014, which is why I started to read the book, with George Clooney, Matt Damon, John Goodman, Bill Murray, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
While we must and will win this war, we should also remember the high price that will be paid if the very foundation of modern society is destroyed.
It's a Michelangelo joke to be made.
You're just the man to make it.
We have been tasked to find and protect art that the Nazis have stolen.
Well, the chaps are all very anxious to get started. We have your architect from Chicago, a sculptor, a director of design at the School of Fine Arts, and a few other experts in various fields of art.
How are the fellas making out? like Olympians.
You want to go into a war zone and tell our boys what they can and cannot blow up.
That's the idea.
If you would just read the orders.
I'll tell you what these orders say. Don't knock out
Colonel
old
DeBilt.
Do not interrupt me, Lieutenant.
I think that went well.
We're going to start with a friend in Paris who's going to have some idea where the French art has been hidden.
How can I help you steal our stolen art?
The Nazis are taking everything with them, so we have to get as close to the front as we can.
Look at this. It says if Hitler dies or if Germany falls, they're to destroy everything. Everything.
We gotta move. They tell us who cares about art, but they're wrong. It is the exact reason that we're fighting. For a culture, for a way of life.
What is all this?
People's lives.
Hitler wants everything.
It's your responsibility now.
Come on, give me a hand!
I'm proud of what we're doing here.
You're gonna miss me so much when this is all over.
All hell's breaking loose here!
We have some unfinished business.
The library has both the book and the movie available for checkout. So here's the basic premise. Because Hitler fancied himself an art aficionado, he decided to, finger quotes, collect famous, expensive pieces of art as he conquered the world. And his plan was to build the best museum in the world, which he was going to humbly name the Führer Museum, in his hometown of Linz, Austria, where he would display these great reclaimed German masterpieces alongside other stuff he thought was really cool. But the museums, like the Louvre and the Tate and all the big museums in Europe, knew something was up, and they had actually been planning for war long before the rest of the world, or at least the U.S., really realized what was going on. So they actually were able to protect some of the artwork by moving it out of the cities into, you know, homes and other hidden locations. But unfortunately, a lot of the artwork, especially that owned by Jewish families, was spirited away to Germany, never to be seen again. And here we come, the Monuments Men. Da 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 da. Their job was not only to protect churches and other famous architectural structures in the path of the Blitzkrieg, so good luck with that, but also to ferret out where all the stolen artwork had been hidden and then send it home. There was a group of, they were about a dozen guys. They didn't really have orders. They didn't really have transportation. Their commanding officers didn't really know what they were doing, but yet they were tasked with this finding of all this artwork and protecting all these monuments that nobody even knew what they were. So kind of impossible. Two of the biggest pieces that they were looking for, and this actually shows up in the movie too, were the Bruges Madonna and the Ghent altarpiece that the Nazis took from Belgium. So my original plan was to read the book and then watch the movie, because usually the books are better, then you can compare and contrast. But there were just so many dang people involved in this book that I couldn't keep them all straight, and so I kind of got lost. So here's what worked for me. This is what I recommend. So you're going to read about a third of the book, get a solid foundation, pay attention to the names of the different people involved, and really get them locked in your brain. Then watch the movie. Notice how in the movie, none of the characters have the same name. But the profiles match to a certain extent, so you can kind of compare and contrast. Enjoy how the movie cuts out all the incredibly tedious details about everyone's assignment and the impossibility of all the tasks. Enjoy the new French character who isn't even in the book. Then be sad when he dies.
Spoiler alert.
So then you cheer when George Clooney and Matt Damon save the day by defeating the Germans and beating the Russians to the art.
Magnifique.
Then you go back and finish the rest of the book, seeing what actually happened and reading more about Rose Valland, who was in her heroic spying for the French artwork. She was a spy in Paris. She worked with the Nazis as they were stealing, and she cataloged everything they stole. So we knew what to look for and kind of where they were taking it. And her part in the movie was cut really short, even if I did like Kate Blanchett as her character. So author Robert Etzel has written two other books under related topics, Saving Italy, which is basically a continuation of the story, i.e. The Monuments 2 Road Trip. Maybe they'll stop at White Castle.
A trip to Italy?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, they enjoy some spaghetti.
That's right.
Holiday
Road. Maybe Chevy Chase will show up. You never know. He also wrote one called Rescuing Da Vinci. I have not decided if I'm going to read these yet. I might just wait for the movie. Fingers crossed.
AKA Monuments 3, The Search for Spock.
Yeah. Search for more money. I think this topic is fascinating. The story really was interesting once I could get into it. And I'm really amazed that they were able to save as much artwork as they did. I kind of go back and forth with myself. Like, was this really a necessary task? I mean, yes, we would miss the artwork. And, you know, these are beautiful pieces of art. But I'm not sure that they're worth sacrificing human lives over. Like, I could live without the Bruges Madonna in my life. It's beautiful, but I'd be okay. And I have a feeling that the Monuments Men would probably disagree with me, which is why they got the job and I'm here talking to you about it.
That's a cool superhero team name.
The Monuments Men.
I've tried that.
I'm Lincoln. I'm Jefferson. So, today I thought I'd recommend a film that I've been... Oh, you're supposed to throw it to me. Oh.
Hey, Mike, what do you got?
Well... Today, I thought I'd recommend a film I've been meaning to recommend since I saw it last year. In fact, I was going to slide it to this Stuff That Is Rather Long episode that we did, but I changed it last minute, so I already wrote about this movie before, so I'm having this weird kind of deja vu, like, have I actually mentioned this before? Am I going to recommend things twice? Groundhog Day. Normally, my attention starts to wander after about an hour and a half, but today's film can be riveted for all of its 161 minutes. The film, The Bridge and the River Kwai, from 1957, directed by David Lean, he who did Lawrence of Arabia. Kwai is about POWs who are tasked with building the Burma Railway during World War II. The movie begins with a large group of British POWs entering a Japanese POW camp to one of the most earwormy whistled tunes in movie history. They are led by Lieutenant Colonel Nicholson, played by Alec Guinness, who demands that the camp's overseer, Saito, follow the Geneva Convention and not force officers to do manual labor. For this insolence, he is sent to the box for a while until his troops do as little work as possible and Saito is forced to relent. Saito confesses that he's been tasked by his superiors to build a bridge over the Kwai River without delay, but is having problems with laying the foundation. Nicholson promises that he can get the bridge built built ahead of time, as long as he's given command of the camp's POWs. Meanwhile, the one American POW, Shears, who is played by William Holden, has escaped and made his way back to America. And in my favorite scene of the film... He is forced by superiors to go back in a commando raid to blow up the bridge. Shears tries everything he can to get out of going back, including admitting that Shears is not his actual name, that he stole the identity of a fellow sailor to get out of work.
Is he Don Draper?
Basically, yeah. But more exciting. But his superiors don't care. They knew that he faked it. It's like, we don't care. You're going back. Huh? Or we need you to volunteer. I don't want to go. You're going to volunteer. I guess I'll volunteer. It is hilarious.
That's why we got you to do the podcast.
Do I have to? Okay. The movie is based on the actual construction of the Burma Railway, which was also known as the Death Railway, which claimed the lives of approximately 100,000 people, including 12,000 POWs. In real life, the construction was mostly done by Southeast Asian civilians, mainly from Malaysia. It's estimated about 90,000 of them died. Also, working conditions in the movie were pretty bad, but in real life, they were much worse. In fact, former POWs actually a protest against the movie back in 1957 that, you know, hey, we had it way worse than this. You know, like in Wikipedia, they have pictures of people who look like they were from concentration camp. This really kind of, you know, worked until they died. The Bridge on the River Kwai is a great film, and not only is it an exciting action/war movie, but also has stuff to say about honor and loyalty and pride and that sort of thing. The acting is great. Like most nerds, I only knew Alec Guinness from him playing Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Which I'm sure he would be really pleased with.
Yeah, from what I recall, he does not like... He did not like that at all.
Obviously, you're not a film nerd, but a nerd of a different species.
Shut up, you guys. I'm going to go back to my room.
Yurt.
You know.
Yurt.
I'll go back to my film nerd yurt. I think that might have been a snob card.
Pardon me, would you have any gray poupon?
But his acting is really great, and he, his last line still sends chills down my spine. He won the Best Picture, Best Actor Oscar. I've seen William Holden in a couple of things, but he's never really impressed me.
Wild Bunch?
He was in that. Oh!
Snob card!
Pardon me, would you have any gray poupon?
Twice! I remember Ernest Borgnine in that movie more than I remember William Holden.
That's a good movie, sorry.
Oh, yeah, it's good.
It's no Bridge Over the River Kwai.
Yeah, exactly. And I like that even the villain is sympathetic in this movie. It's revealed that he, like, you know, if he doesn't build the bridge in time, he has to commit ritual suicide. So, like, his leadership style smacks more of desperation to me and not, like, cruelty, which I think is kind of neat. Good stuff.
My
I just wanted to say, even though I pulled my snob card, this is an awesome movie. Like, one of the all-time best.
Yeah.
I have not seen that movie.
You should.
It's great.
It's a hole in my viewing. But
this what have you got, Jeremy?
No. This may be a correction later, but was it filmed in Thailand?
It was filmed in Sri Lanka.
Sri Lanka, okay.
Formerly
so
Ceylon.
Did they? Wow. But was the.
Wage War 2, right?
Was the. Maybe my friend went to Sri Lanka. I have a friend that went. Maybe he just. Is the River Kwai in. Does it run through? I don't know.
It's based on. It's got a different name in real life. It's. I mean, in fact, I think it may be in Vietnam.
Oh well, my friend.
The bits that they dramatize in the film.
Well, my friend went to Thailand and he had something to do. Like there was a bridge there, and there was something to do with that movie or something. And well, anyway, if that's not true.
In Wikipedia, they showed the bridge today, which is like made of concrete, and the supports for the bridge were donated by the Japanese government as a form of reparations.
Oh wow!
I was like, ooh.
Well, if
our bad. Here's a bridge.
Yeah. I was also amused that I read on Wikipedia that the Japanese didn't protest how bad they treated prisoners about the film. They protested that that we've got really good engineers. We didn't need some Englishmen to tell us how to build this bridge. Thank you very much.
Killed many slave labor. People, yeah, but, you know.
That's funny.
Which maybe that.
That's really funny. Well, my friend went to Thailand, and I thought he said that he had went to see this bridge, and walked across it. And, like, as he came off the ferry or wherever he was to get into it, there was, like, a tourist trap thing where they would take your picture and then they would put it basically like a sticker, make a sticker of it and put it on a plate with, like, writing and stuff on it. And he was like, I don't want that plate. And he's like, he looks all, he's shaved head and he's like, looks all kind of, like, sweaty and, like, kind of, like, angry a little bit. And he's wearing a black T-shirt that says Jackie Chan's First Strike on it. And he just looks like really, it's really funny. And then, he's like, I don't want that. And he's like, wait, I know who should have this. And he bought it for my wife and me. And it's on my mantle at home.
Now you're spaghetti off of it.
I've never eaten off of it. It's too sacred.
Real Life River is called the Mekong. It's in Thailand.
Thank you.
Editor's note. Great segue. No, really.
Bart Simpson said there are only three good wars, the Revolutionary War, World War II, and the Star Wars trilogy. So I'm going to talk about Nick Fury from Marvel Comics.
Because he's not an idiot.
That's right. No, he fought. Actually, that was
the
a tangent.
Commandos,
that
I
was
guess.
A tangent that I took myself on. That was a trip
in your
I
head.
Took. And I didn't. I thought, oh, it's not related. But whatever. I want to say that. And it is related. So Nick Fury is known to most of our listeners as Samuel Jackson's eye-patched character from all of the Avengers-related movies.
Of
the
last. Iron Man was David Hasselhoff from the TV movie.
Yes,
David Hasselhoff was Nick Fury?
Yes. Yeah.
I was not aware of that.
In the 90s.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Not a good
Knight
way.
Rider.
Yeah.
Watch career.
Yeah, wow. I'd forgotten about that. Thank you, Mike.
No, really.
People know him from those movies from the last 7 years or so, but he's been around in Marvel Comics since 1963. First, he was
Nick Fury, not Samuel Jackson.
Samuel Jackson, I believe, is older than that,
okay.
But yes.
Just
yes.
Clarify.
Thank you. I was dangling some participles over there or whatever. My verbs weren't agreeing. First, he was Sergeant Fury, leader of the Howling Commandos, an elite World War II unit featuring a racially integrated cast. Now, it should be maybe noted here that Fury was a white guy in the comics until 2001, when they introduced an African-American Nick Fury in a different universe. He was patterned specifically on Samuel Jackson, which created a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy for the then gestating Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Well, you know, actually, in Earth-616, they introduced a Nick Fury that looks like Samuel L. Jackson now.
Oh, so
Nick Fury Jr.
And
then regular Nick Fury died, and now Nick Fury Jr. is Nick Fury.
Wow.
I
am not as up to date on that. Thank you. Thank you for
sending. Back to my yurt now.
Thank you for sending dorkier than me.
You guys.
It's going to be bad, right, when Marvel Studios starts dictating what the comics look like?
Oh, it's too late.
Oh,
too late, brah.
They've already, they've suppressed, X-Men and Fantastic Four because they don't have, the movie rights anymore.
Yeah.
So now, Fantastic Four is, disbanded. And
yeah. It's crazy, man. So in the 1960s, Nick Fury existed in comics both as a combatant in World War II and in a then contemporary continuity as an agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., the Supreme Headquarters International Espionage Law Enforcement Division. These were the days of Uncle and Spectre and other acronym names, which Mike will now supplement, maybe.
They were cool.
Smersh.
Smersh, yeah, that's okay.
You know, KGB.
Yeah, there you go. AIM, Advanced Idea Mechanics. So, Nick Fury has endured. It's like the old saying, old soldiers never die, they just fade away, except for the fading away part and the dying part, which I wasn't 100% sure of.
It filled in a minute ago, yeah.
Yeah, so Mike, thank you, Mike. So, 2012's Fury, My War Gone is a contemporary comic which sort of plays fast and loose with the established continuity of Nick Fury's history. But it's written by Garth Ennis and illustrated by Goran Parlov. And when I read it a few years ago for the first time, it prompted the following conversation on Goodreads. Brian, I want to write You're Dead to Me for liking an Ennis book, but I won't write that. Jeremy, I'm not really a fan of his work. I read Preacher and liked it fine, but as soon as I finished it, I thought, actually, that was pretty awful. So my assessment of this book was and is, it's a pretty solid comic book about war, featuring Garth Ennis, who's aforementioned Preacher, went to some pretty extreme lengths to gross out the reader.
I loved Preacher up until the end, so.
Yeah, I
Snob card or Teeny Out card or...
Don't bring me down!
Was great to the end, Brown.
I liked reading it, and then when I read it, I was like, this is just kind of gross out. I liked the concept a lot. But so in this book, I thought, oh, he showed some actual restraint amidst a still pretty high level of sex and violence. But rereading it, I am surprised that I ever thought it was restrained. In it, Nick Fury sits in a hotel room dictating his life story into a tape recorder, and he goes through his history of covert missions, near-death experiences, hardcore boozing, assassinations. There's blood, booze, and bosoms on nearly every page. We see Nick Fury in the 50s in what was then Indochina. We see him on the beaches of Cuba. We see him tangling with a corrupt senator. It's what you would expect from this type of story. It's absolutely solid, but not remotely restrained. It's certainly more fantastical than the other stuff in here, and has a little bit of espionage thrown in with the war stuff. It sort of shows the toll that kind of life would take on a person.
Do you think the Nick Fury character was the inspiration for the comedian in The Watchmen?
Yes. I think so.
Hmm.
I know the original pitch for Watchmen was that they were going to take existing characters that had belonged to Charlton Comics,
yeah.
which DC bought, and they were going to, he was going to like, kill all of them or whatever, but DC wanted to use those characters in their actual continuity, and they said, you can't do that. So he made analogs to them all, basically.
Yeah.
So, like,
the question
Rorschach
is
the question.
That Blue Beetle is now.
Yeah. So I don't know who they would have had. I think the comedian might have been the Shield, which was like an old Simon and Kirby character. But I think also the Nick Fury angle has to be there.
Maybe I'm wrong.
But if not, it's a chicken and egg thing, too. Because if it didn't come from Nick Fury, then the current take on Nick Fury certainly probably came from there.
From the comedian.
Yeah.
I don't know anything about comics. I don't know what I'm talking about. Back to the real world. So the book that I wanted to talk about today was Where Men Win Glory, The Odyssey of Pat Tillman by John Krakauer. John Krakauer is one of those popular nonfiction authors that can take any subject matter and make it interesting. Yeah, he's right up there with Eric Larson or Michael Lewis, like things you don't think you would care about, and it makes it interesting. Maybe unless you lived in a cave, no pun intended. Pat Tillman was a professional football player who left professional sports to join the Army after 9/11. He was tragically killed in 2004 by a friendly fire while deployed in Afghanistan. Because he was such a high-profile person, like a lot of people tried to use his story for their political agenda, like on both sides of the fence. But Krakauer is a really great journalist. He's a really great writer. He sort of untangles all of this. He doesn't have any axes to grind or a particular point of view. And even though Tillman was a young man when he was killed, he was a complicated and interesting person. And, you know, like most real people, like they don't like fit the cookie cutters that people in the media like want them to be. So Krakauer kind of untangles all those threads. He was a young person, though, so the book is short. So it's also, there's a lot of stuff in there about the history of Al-Qaeda and our military involvement in Afghanistan up to that point when the book was published. It's one of these books where I was actually reading another book, but I started reading this book, and then I just could not put it down. Krakauer is just really compulsively readable. I want to read Krakauer's new book, which is about rape on college campuses, but we're probably not going to do an episode of Popmatic about that. But I just wanted to get...
one about college.
That's a special deleted episode.
So
right after the priest in love episode.
Probably.
Oh, yeah, the priest love one. We're going to go out with a bang, listeners.
My out for being that, I mean, I'm the one person that probably always goes, like, way too heavy anyway, but my out is like, well, Tillman was a pro football player, so everybody knows him. He's like, he's a note in pop culture.
And they tried to spin his story that it wasn't friendly fire, that he was in, it was in combat,
right?
Yeah,
they denied
it
for a while.
Yeah, they tried to cover it up.
I don't want to give away any...
We're going to spoil the book.
Yeah, I don't want to give away any spoilers. You know, it's like, it's a really interesting story. It was
there's
like,
a documentary too, I believe.
There was a documentary, but I would even say that the book was like way more interesting and detail oriented than a documentary. Because you know when you craft a documentary, you kind of have to like fudge things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because it was contemporary history, and he was only talking about like one incident in a short span of time. Like Krakauer could get very, very detailed about what happened in the weeks before he was killed, what actually happened that day, like down to the minute, you know. So you just couldn't really do that in a movie. So check it out, Where Men Win Glory: The Odyssey of Pat Tillman. So readable, even if you don't think you're interested, you probably get hooked and really like it. Hey, where'd Bill go? I'm setting up my team for disaster. That's what's tickling.
As per usual.
We appreciate the love.
That is what is tickling my fancy this week, is to me making it impossible for my team to be professional and do a good job.
When I was asked
to come to the show, you made it impossible to be professional. I'm a saboteur.
So this is the new improvised tagline for the Tickle My Fancy segment. Maybe the library has it. Maybe it doesn't. It's tickling our fancy this week. Amanda.
I wish that rhymed. That's really cool, but I wish it rhymed. I don't know what rhymes or doesn't, though. Cousin.
Was it?
Wasn't.
But you have to say it like that, and you always have to throw to Amanda first. Amanda. Because Mike.
Mike.
You got to have those syllables. Jeremy. I guess Jeremy.
Jeremy works. Jeremy.
Yeah. Amanda.
How are you? I like
Lisa Frank Chapakipa.
That would tickle my fancy. I love Lisa Frank.
Lisa Frank is so good, you guys. I'm like, gah.
Were there consonants in there?
Are you good? You know Lumpy Space Princess from
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I'm like, gah.
Whatever.
God, he is so hot. You guys, man.
Oh, yeah, 20 minutes.
I can say Michael. I don't have to say Mike.
Michael.
I can say.
Oh, Michael, I see.
Maybe the library has it. Maybe it doesn't. It's tickling our fancy. Michael.
There's a sexy like, tone to that.
I think we might need to leave you alone on that one.
Yeah,
I like where Mike says his own name. Mac.
Mac.
How about...
Do you need to throw it to me again?
Amanda. Amanda.
Yes, Brian. Are we ready to do this?
Do it.
Okay.
You want to start over? No.
So for Tickling My Fancy this week, my husband has brought to my attention the fabulous YouTube channel called Honest Trailers, which is produced by Screen Junkies, which I don't know if that's just one person in his mom's basement or a comedy troupe or whatever, but it's funny.
Yeah, the narrator guy.
Yeah, the narrator guy. So basically what this is, you know, you've all seen the trailers on TV and in the movie theater for upcoming flicks. So this is more for past flicks that are already out that you wish you would have seen before you saw the movie. So I have a couple, and he's done a bunch of them. There's like, I want to say like 50 or 30 or 9 million, whatever. But the three that I liked so far... For Frozen, starring forgotten Sarah Marshall and the wickedly talented Adele Dazeem. Or The Avengers, where you can watch Iron Man repair a spaceship for 20 minutes. Or my favorite was The Matrix, the mind-blowing sci-fi game changer, and the two sequels that took a huge steaming dump on it. And they're like 4-minute trailers, and they use, you know, footage from the real movie, and they're hilarious. And if you have a minute at work and it's not blocked on your computer, feel free to enjoy. It is, and they have their own YouTube channel, so you can just Google them.
Also note that they're spoiler-tastic, so if you
they
have
are
not spoiler- seen the movie,
fantastic. Sometimes they warn you, sometimes they don't. Yeah. Sometimes they warn you after the fact.
So kind of like us.
That's why I felt right at home there. I also did want to mention just briefly, I had talked about Scott Bradley's Postmodern Jukebox on the podcast before. They're a band. Mike's dad liked them. Hi, Mike's dad. They're actually coming to Nashville to the Cannery Ballroom on May 21st, which... from when this posts, it'll be the Thursday after this posts at 8 p.m. So if you listen to us and now you like them, feel free to go see them at the Cannery Ballroom. Mike, what's tickling your fancy?
Well, Amanda.
See what I did there?
Yeah, I like the excellent seek.
You're welcome.
So I thought I would continue my Southeast Asian theme. I've got two things. One, at Third Man Records on May 21st, they're showing a documentary called Don't Think I've Forgotten, Cambodia's Lost Rock and Roll.
Ooh.
Apparently, Cambodia had a thriving music scene in the 50s and 60s that was cut short by the rise of the Khmer Rouge. Like, most of them are dead.
Yes.
I've never been to Third Man Records or seen their light and sound show machine thingy, so I'm kind of excited. And a related note, much like Antibalas and Afrobeat, there's a modern American band that continues the lost traditions of another country's music. In this case, it's called Dengue Fever, which is kind of like a modern American take on Cambodian rock and roll. Formed in 2001 after two American brothers went to Cambodia and tracked down as much of the old Cambodian rock they could find. They recruited a female lead singer whose name I'm going to butcher. I think it's called Chahamnimol, who was a famous karaoke singer in Cambodia, apparently, to be the lead singer. So most of the lyrics in their first two albums are in Khmer, one of the languages of Cambodia. But eventually they become like more of a mix of Khmer and English. Thanks to the magic of PS4 Spotify, mentioned in a previous episode, Oye Como Va, I've been playing a song called Cement Slippers from their album Cannibal Courtship on Infinite Repeat. We have it on Hoopla.
That the people from that band put together of some of the old Cambodian stuff. It's here, I think. It's really good.
The title of that record is Dengue Fever Presents Electric Cambodia.
What's tickling my fancy this week is something available, an audiobook available on Hoopla, which is great when the app doesn't crap out on me, which it's been doing. Yeah, which is, it's been doing like every time I listen to this book. So my progress is not. I have not made as much progress.
Has it taken you a year and a half? Because that's the record so far.
That is not. Yeah. I cannot top that.
Okay.
However, so I will begin preface this by going on a tangent. And several years ago, I had some brickwork done on my house.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy came in to, we just had to
Where's
talk or
go?
I had to pay, I had to pay him or whatever. And he came in and he was just sort of looking at around at my house and stuff. And on top
he said, nice plate.
He did not.
Oh.
That's amazing.
Call back.
Good reinsertion. Job. Like
reinsertion
it.
Of a shelved idea. Well done. He looked up at my CDs and he saw a box set and he said, your boy's in jail. And I said, what? And he was pointing at the Phil Spector box set on top of my CDs because Phil Spector had just been sentenced to prison for killing actress and model Lana Clarkson. And so the book that's tickling my fancy is not about that murder. It's called Tearing Down the Wall of Sound by Nick Brown, and it's the story of Phil Spector. Yep. It's a I actually own a print copy of this book that I got for my birthday several years ago and just have not gotten around to reading, and I saw that it was on Hoopla, and it is read by the greatest living audio narrator who is not Will Patton, Ray Porter, who is also reading, who also read the one I talked about last week, the Metallica book, and he's fantastic. Related to this, I also just listened to a book about the Wrecking Crew, which was the session musicians, which were sort of the magic behind a lot of those Phil Spector records, and both are really great.
The book that Jeremy is speaking of is The Wrecking Crew, The Inside Story of Rock and Roll's Best Kept Secret by Kent Hartman.
Somebody throw it to me.
Hey, Brian! I'm Jello the Abra!
Oh, sorry. Everything after I put my plug in is not going to be in the podcast. We're talking about Phil Spector shooting people.
Brian. Brian. What is tickling your fancy, Brian?
Our segues get better and better with every show.
I just kicked the table.
I'm going back to war. You know, I'm Johnny Serious all the time.
What is it good for? I can finally take it anymore.
All right.
Anyway.
That's good. I wanted to talk about The Devil is in These Hills, West Virginia Coal Miners and Their Battle for Freedom by James R. Green. Yes, it's a history of the West Virginia Coal Wars.
Cool.
A low-grade guerrilla warfare between mine owners and miners that took place in the early 20th century, like before 1920. Like, this is this long, low-grade guerrilla warfare, and it was a war. The miners organized into units and armies and fought against mine owners. Crazy. I think it's a forgotten piece of history. A third of all electric power in the United States is still made from coal. We get coal by sending human beings down under the ground to dig it out. We dig it out with big, horrible monster grinding machines as opposed to picks and shovels, but you can just pick your poison, I guess, which is worse to be down in a hole with.
Well, sometimes they just take the top right off the mountain.
Sometimes. That's a new thing. But this is a forgotten part of history where there was a real war, like almost like an internal like civil war, like a civil war or like private war that didn't involve the government inside the United States. It's like, it's bizarro world.
It's West Virginia.
You know, exactly.
Whoa. Virginia. I didn't want to say it.
Oh, man. Sorry, listeners from Huntington.
Well, you know what? The one thing that I just keep thinking when
Gary from Huntington.
like Maynard from Huntington.
Oh, yeah.
Virgil.
So this is the one thing that I keep thinking when I read this book is, you know, there was that movie that came out a few years ago, it was a documentary, like The Wild and Wonderful Whites. And it was a documentary.
Yes, it's very good, yeah.
It was a documentary about arguably the bad aspects about West Virginia. But I can remember one of the pundits, he was actually, I think, a lawyer who represents this crazy white trash family who commits crimes in West Virginia, right? And makes music. speaking of bad music.
Yeah, he was like a dancer, yeah. And then he got murdered and, like, anyway.
So anyway, one of the lawyers was like, actually, like, people don't think about it this way, but Appalachia is usually treated like a third world country, like sort of inside the United States, to use that metaphor, that there are these natural resources here, and then the people who sort of live around or near those natural resources are basically get to be second place next to the profits that can be made from the natural resources. So that's, the other thing I keep thinking about when I'm reading this book, and it's totally enthralling too, at least maybe for just me because I'm interested, is like Scott McClanahan is a novelist who writes about West Virginia and the history of violence in the state that I've talked about on the podcast. Big central metaphor in all of Scott McClanahan's work, you know, are the mountains of West Virginia, is it a graveyard? Or are the mountains like pregnant with life? So, which metaphor better applies? So reading this book, it's a graveyard. it's one of those things where truth is stranger than fiction. And in typical Brian fashion, I haven't finished it yet. I know that eventually...
Business as usual.
I know that eventually, like, troops are sent in, you know, to make peace. And we're still mining coal in West Virginia.
Harlan County, USA, that was not, like, a full-out war. But there was shooting and fighting between union and non-union people in that movie. Is that right?
There was still violence, yes, between union miners and coal owners and their...
Scabs.
Not scabs. Well, I don't think even scabs, but just like... they would hire enforcers. Like, they would hire people to do such things. That was in the 70s. By the way, the name that Jeremy just said, Harlan County, USA, was a documentary about coal miners in Kentucky. An amazing movie, one of the best documentaries ever made. The first film directed by a woman in the National Film Registry, Harlan County, USA. Great soundtrack, too, if you like bluegrass. As the host and editor, any bad segues are my fault. Lizzie Gardner was the costume designer who made and wore the American Express card dress to the Oscars. Any other corrections?
She did leave home. She did not leave home without it.
I'm going to think about that a few more times.
Ooh,
sorry.
Wow.
Got kind of bumpy there for a minute.
Yep, I couldn't keep it together. Sorry.
Is that American Express? Is that their tagline?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Don't leave home without us.
Yeah. Okay. So, at least it used to be.
At that point it was.
I learned, too, that she actually designed that dress for Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, but American Express was like, no, you can't use that dress. So. Huh.
But I remember after she won the Oscars, American Express ran ads in several magazines with her holding her Oscar, and it said, thanks, Lindsay.
Yeah. Bunch of jerks. Yeah.
Their credit card company.
Yeah. Jeez.
For more information about credit card companies and their tactics, you can go to
www.library.nashville.org.
That theme music is by
Adam Dean.
Next week,
America!
Indy 500.
To travel by car in my world, or else you'll fall into the lumpy abyss.
Daughter, have you brought smooth people into our domain?
I had to, Dad. I'm trying to help them, so don't lump and yell at me.
What did you just say?
I said lump off, Mom. Let my go. What?
Vroom, vroom?
Oh, yeah. I need to borrow the car.
You have made your mother cry for the last time, daughter. You are hereby banned from using the royal car.
Shucks. I lumping hate them. I'm really, really sorry, Fun. But I can't help you because my parents are horrible idiots. I'm going to say something fun like, oh, yeah, I'm having a fun time. Oh, my gosh. Probably the best time I've ever had in my entire life.
Hey, now. Royal intervention! Surely there must be an antidote to the lumps.
Yeah, there's an antidote, but you have to go all the way to lumpy space to get it, and Jake has to use it by sunset.
What happens if he doesn't take the antidote by sunset?
He'll be lumpy, forever.
LSP, please! Can you tell us how to reach lumpy space?
Yeah, I mean, there's a portal nearby. I can show you whenever.
Take us now! Take us now!
I should not have drunk that much tea!
Don't go telling everyone about this portal or whatever. It's kind of a secret.
Where is it?
Portal's that frog and mushroom.
Ribbit. Password, please.
Whatever, it's 2009!
Good day, princess. Is your father okay with you entering lumpy space with two non-lumpers?
Just say yes! Yes, yes, yes!
Nah, whatever, fine.
Lumpy space.